So if you think the Republican National Convention is a little bit contentious, let me read you the lead from a Kansas City Star piece on August 15, 1976. What is the status of the great gray elephant, the Republican Party, as it arrives in Kansas City for what could be one of the greatest political bloodlettings in modern-day American history? Turns out that 76 convention at Kemper Arena was the last contested party convention, and it pitted President Gerald Ford, who rose to the presidency after Richard Nixon resigned because of Watergate, against Ronald Reagan, who was becoming the darling of conservatives. Joining us now to talk about that bloodletting in the West Bottoms is Craig Shirley, a historian and public affairs consultant. He's the author of three bestsellers on Reagan, including Rendezvous with Destiny, Ronald Reagan and the Campaign That Changed America, and Reagan's Revolution. He joins us by phone from his office outside of Washington, D.C. Mr. Shirley, thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
And Bill Lacey, the director of the Dole Institute of Politics. He's a longtime Republican political operative, including serving in the Reagan administration, and he joins us from the studios of Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence. Bill, thank you.
Good to be with you, Sam. Always good to be with Craig.
Yeah, likewise, Bill. How are you?
Good. How are you, sir?
I'm hanging in there. I'm glad I'm not in Cleveland.
You and me both.
All right. Well, I'm going to jump in here, if it's okay with you guys.
Sure, yeah.
I want to go back to bloodletting, and I want to start with you, Craig. Was it a bloodletting at Kemper Arena?
Yes, in a way. There were obviously. There were heated arguments. There were some hijinks. The Ford boys, young men, dumped trash on the Texas delegation because the Texas delegation was supporting Reagan. Nelson Rockefeller, the vice president, got involved in a melee live on national television over a placard, the Reagan placard that he tore up and then was ripped out of his hands by, I believe, a North Carolina delegate. And it was so there was a lot of contention. It was heated. Literally, the Kemper Arena was there. People were packed in like sardines. It was very hot. There was a blue cloud over the arena as people, you know, smoked cigars and cigarettes and pipes and just stubbed them out on the floor. But it was also deeper than that. It was the culmination of a split that had been going on inside the Republican Party since the time of Taft and Eisenhower. Which came to a head in 64 at the Cow Palace in San Francisco with Goldwater and against Rockefeller, and erupted again with Ford representing the establishment, Reagan representing the populist outsider conservatives who were trying to take the party back once again. So it was significant and it was important, as we now know.
I want to go back before 1976 and talk about what led up to this. But first, Bill, I want to get your thoughts. Was it a bloodletting? Was the Kansas City Star right?
Yeah, I think it was a bloodletting in the sense of what was going on at the very beginning, Sam. And very clearly, there was a major philosophical dispute in the party, as Craig has laid out. I think at the end of the day, though, and this is maybe the distinct difference with what we're seeing in Cleveland this week, at the end of the day, Ronald Reagan went out, gave a very gracious speech at President Ford's behest, and everybody knew exactly where he stood at the end of that convention, and it was very much in President Ford's camp, and that's a clear distinction from what we saw last night.
Right. So set the time for me. What was happening in America that made this such a contentious convention? You know, we're coming off bitter conventions for really both parties in 1968 and 1972. Craig, did that play a role? I mean, you mentioned the 64 convention as well.
Yeah, I suppose it did play a role, but it was a different sort of role. Is that the fights in America at that time were more cultural. It was the anti-war protesters and the Vietnam War and race relations hung over both parties, especially in 68 and 72. By 76, the Democrats, of course, you know, New York City, were gathered at a unusual unity and harmony convention where they nominated former Governor Jimmy Carter. The Republicans reverted back to 64 in terms of an ideological fight. Culture didn't hang over the convention per se, but it was definitely a fight between Nixon's view of the world and Gerald Ford's continuation of Nixon's policies versus Reagan and Goldwater and the conservatives' view of the world. And that's really what the contention was that they just didn't see eye to eye on anything, whether it was Henry Kissinger, the Panama Canal treaties, the Helsinki Accords, Alexander Solzhenitsyn on issue after issue after issue. And, of course, central to all of this was the Cold War, that you had the Nixon policy of detente, which was continued by Gerald Ford, and Reagan's urging of the discarding of detente, the discarding of the SALT negotiations, and the reassertion of America's military strength, the ignoring the Helsinki Accords, and dealing with the Soviets from a position of strength instead of weakness.
So am I hearing you say that we're seeing what would be, in contemporary terms, conservatives led by the Reagan faction and a more moderate group of Republicans on the Ford side?
No, most definitely is more moderate, but also more distinctly, there was geographic differences, there were ideological differences, there were power differences, there were philosophical differences, there were less somewhat cultural differences, like in 68 or even now going on in Cleveland. I think it's as much the difference between Cruz and Trump is as much cultural as it is anything else, and it's more a fight over who is the real populist versus who is the real conservative.
I want to open up the phone lines. If you have some remembrances about 1976, questions for either of our guests, call us at 816-236-2886. Oh, I'm sorry, 235-2888. I think I was giving you my cell number. Don't call that. Bill, I want to ask you, so the Republicans come into Kansas City, and they know who they're running against. The Democrats have nominated Jimmy Carter from Georgia, Fritz Mondale as VP. How do you think that affected, knowing who they were going to run against, how that affected what happened at the convention?
I don't think, and Craig would be more of an authority on this, Sam, but I don't think it affected anything at all. I think the die was cast on the Republican side. The president was running for re-election. As we've talked about, there was a clear ideological distinction. This was a philosophical challenge from an outsider who still had been part of the party for a long time. And I think that basically what happened is that it had nothing to do with who the Democratic nominee was in this case. I think that the people who ultimately came supporting President Ford wound up supporting him. The people who ultimately came to Kansas City supporting Governor Reagan supported him. There wasn't a whole lot of flux, even though the Reagan folks tried some creative things at the convention to shake things up, including naming Dick Schweiker his vice presidential candidate. Things pretty much stayed status quo, and that was why Ford won the nomination.
Right. Craig, you agree with that, that
they
really
didn't
care?
Yeah, no, I agree with Bill entirely. The first of all, Carter had won the nomination by acclamation, and when they gathered in Kansas City, Carter was ahead in the polls by 30 points, so a lot of people thought the presidential nomination of the Republican Party was probably going to be worthless, but it's better to figure out what we stand for. Do we stand with Ford's type of vision of Republicanism, or do we stand with Reagan's vision of Republicanism? So Bill's right, is that the nominee of the Democratic Party had no effect whatsoever on what happened in Kansas City.
You know, as I was going back and reading reporting contemporaneous with the convention, I saw that the Mississippi delegation was quite important, and I was struck by that. So I'd like to hear from both of you about why Mississippi became one of those key delegations that both sides were after. Both campaigns had assigned staff people to essentially monitor what they were doing. So, Craig, why did Mississippi become? Well, we actually have quite a long time, but but that's not. But let's not get too far afield. But so, why was Mississippi so important?
In the shorthand is that the chairman of the Mississippi Republican Party, Clark Reed, had professed being a Reagan supporter and admirer for years, and promised to the Reagan campaign that he would deliver his 30 delegates to support Ronald Reagan at the right place at the right time. unless the one stipulation was, if Reagan's candidacy became a joke, then they'd be free to vote their own preferences. And Reagan's candidacy wasn't a joke. As a matter of fact, as when they met in Kansas City, is that neither side had enough delegates for a first ballot nomination as of that point. It was the first time since 1952 when Eisenhower and Taft met in Chicago that people did not know who the nominee of their party was going to be. So those 30 delegates became extremely important. The shorthand is that Clark Reed betrayed his promise to the Reagan campaign and instead delivered his 30 votes to the Ford campaign. And this just sent shockwaves through Kansas City, because the rationale was if Reagan is losing votes among his stronghold in the South, that he's probably losing votes everywhere else. And so there were about 150 uncommitted delegates in Kansas City, and they started gravitating toward Ford because they thought Reagan's candidacy was over, mainly because Mississippi had abandoned Reagan.
And did this have everything to do with the Mississippi delegation, or did it have anything to do with the changing South? Probably by 1976, we're looking at not a Democratic South, but more of a Republican South on the national level. So did that play into it, Craig?
No, not really. And don't forget, in 76 is that, of course, Carter is the nominee, so the South reverts back to being a solid Democratic South. And in many ways, Carter restitched the old New Deal coalition of northern urban cities and the agrarian South. And as a matter of fact, he carried the entire South with the exception of Virginia in 1976. There were states in the South that had no federal Republicans in office, no congressmen, no senators. There were states that had almost no Republicans in state government positions in the legislature. So it was still very much of a yellow dog, region, you know. But Mississippi had a small contingent of the Republican Party. They started electing, for instance, Trent Lott was elected to Congress as a Republican, and I can't remember. There's another congressman at the time who was elected. So they started making slow progress, but still, is that the South is still primarily Democratic.
Bill, tell me how you wrangled delegates back in 1976. Not you personally, but how would one go about wrangling and making sure that they were either staying in your camp or trying to lure them over?
Well, both camps use very different approaches. The president's camp, President Ford's camp, used all kinds of wonderful things, from White House trinkets to nights at the White House to opportunities for delegates to meet the president, all that kind of stuff. And that is extremely powerful, especially inside a political party. I mean, even though Ford had been appointed, he was the Republican president of the United States, he did carry a certain amount of clout and a certain amount of respect built in within the party. And that was one of the things that they had going for them. They also argued very, very strongly that he would be the best candidate for the general election. I think on the Reagan side, largely, it was a philosophical argument. They were really making the case to the true believers, people who were philosophically conservative, like Craig said, did not like the course that Nixon had pursued as president, moving towards the center fairly dramatically, had felt that Ford had continued that a little bit too long as president, and a number of things that he had done, and saw Reagan as being the individual who could propel the Republican Party forward and give us a period of successful Republican conservative rule, which Reagan, in fact, did. But it wasn't until 1980 when he won the nomination and did that.
So I want to go back to, so in 1976, you could buy yourself a delegate for a White House keychain. I mean, we didn't have to promise jobs or, you know, help with a campaign. I mean, it seems like, you know, kind of a cheap way to buy a delegate.
Probably a little bit more with the overnights at the White House and promise of patronage and stuff like that. But there was a lot of fascinating stuff going on.
Yeah. So both campaigns are coming into Kansas City. We both know that there's not a first ballot victory. So, Craig, talk to me about what sort of groundwork was laid by both campaigns. What do they do before they got to Kansas City to soften up the ground, as they might say?
Well, as Bill mentioned earlier, of course, Reagan had made the unprecedented decision to pick his running mate, Senator Richard Schweiker of Pennsylvania, even before they met in Kansas City, even before the balloting. The real reason why or a large part of the reason why, was that through the spring and summer of 1976, both camps were floating phony numbers in order to gain a psychological advantage. Jim Baker would hold a press conference in which he said they have 1,187 delegates. Then John Sears would hold a dueling press conference and said, no, we have 1,187 delegates. So this fog machine just confused everybody. So finally, CBS News, their political unit, which was very, very impressive in those days, they had millions to spend and lots of staff and pollsters and consultants. The head of the CBS political unit at the time was Marty Plister, and he said, to heck with it. We're going to count ourselves. We don't believe the Ford campaign. We don't believe the Reagan campaign. Sears knows that CBS is doing this. They're going to count every delegate and every alternate in the United States, and that it's going to show that Ford is very, very close to the nominee. Not over it, not doesn't have it, but he's very close. And he dreads the idea of Walter Cronkite going on television, and at that time CBS had a 55 share, and saying, CBS News has learned that President Gerald Ford has near enough committed or leading delegates for a first ballot nomination. So he needs to change the storyline, which impels him to ask Dick Schweiker, and Reagan agreed, for Schweiker to run. They know that Pennsylvania is very key because there's a lot of uncommitted delegates in Pennsylvania. And if the Schweiker goes on the ticket, that's going to force CBS to cancel their story, which is exactly what they did, because it just added new mystery and new doubt about which way the delegates were going to go, especially in Pennsylvania. So it worked to the extent that it killed the CBS story, and it kept Reagan's campaign alive for the 3 weeks leading up to the Kansas City convention.
Schweiker was a senator from Pennsylvania. I think, Craig, most people would consider him moderate, yes.
It depended. He was on labor votes. Yes, he was moderate to liberal. On other votes, such as life, Second Amendment, captive nations, national defense, he was a conservative. On the other hand, too, is that he was one of the first Republicans to go on Richard Nixon's enemies list. So Richard Schweiker was a tremendous man, a great patriot, a war hero of World War II. Never had any scandal or whiff of scandal ever come close to him. I knew him very, very well, and Bill did too. He's just a terrific, terrific individual, and he was flattered. He admired Reagan very, very much, so he was happy to go on the ticket with Reagan.
Yeah, Bill Lacey, give me your thoughts on Richard Schweiker.
Yeah, I would agree with Craig. Schweiker was very courageous to do that. It was a great, bold effort. It ultimately failed, but it's the kind of thing that Ronald Reagan did throughout his career. He was never afraid to throw deep, and more often than not, he connected.
This hour, we're looking at the 1976 convention with Bob Lacey of the Dole Institute and Reagan scholar and biographer Craig Shirley. Gentlemen, thanks for staying with us.
You bet.
Thank you.
And now Bob Dole is a legend now in Republican politics, ran for president in 1976, longest serving Senate Majority Leader, I think. And people really just went wild when he jumped on the Twitter. But in 1976, it wasn't so. Not all Republicans were pleased with him as the vice presidential candidate. So, Craig, talk to me about that.
Oh, I think people were very pleased with him. I don't think there was any votes against him when his name was placed in nomination. Not only that, the backstory is that Ford and Reagan met alone in the Alameda Hotel after Ford had won the nomination, and by prior agreement, the winner would call upon the loser. So Ford went to Reagan's hotel. The two of them met there alone, unbeknownst at the time, but I later found out, and I wrote in my book, that a Reagan staffer had hidden in the kitchen area of the suite. She couldn't get out in time, but she just sat there and listened quietly. And she said there was a very pleasant conversation. There was no acrimony. It was just the two of them sitting on facing sofas. But so Ford asked Reagan for his advice on running mates. Now, prior, Senator Dole had asked his old friend Lynn Nofsinger, who was a key Reagan aide, if If Reagan is asked by Ford about a running mate, would you ask him to please say something nice about me? And Nofsinger, of course, was a World War II hero. Bob Dole was a World War II hero. There was a special fraternity between the two men, and they'd known each other for a long time, and not Lynn had worked for Senator Dole. So he said, "You're sure? Of course I will." So he mentioned to Governor Reagan that, you know, if the president asks you, please say something nice about Bob Dole. So anyway, Ford hands a list of potential running mates, Howard Baker and Bill Brock and others, and Reagan speaks up favorably about Bob Dole, who, of course, Gerald Ford then picks. So is that one person who did come out looking very, very well, and history is recorded very kindly about his Senator Dole, because he really stepped into it. You know, at the last minute, he's going on a ticket to the 30 points down. He's got to make a fight of it. He's going up against Walter Mondale, who is, you know, a very popular senator. So, you know, he had a tough road to hoe, but he handled it very, very well.
Yeah. Now, when you read some of the contemporary reporting, it doesn't read at the time that Bob Dole was going to sail through. Bill, what do you remember about that? You're as close to Bob Dole as anybody.
I remember it exactly the way that Craig just described it. I don't remember a lot of opposition to Senator Dole at all. I don't think there was any. I was not associated with him at the time. That was a good 10 years before I worked for him in any capacity. But I remember being as a pretty popular choice. And as a Reagan guy, it was pretty popular to me for the reason that Craig just said, is that Reagan had kind of, in one way, recommended Senator Dole. Sam, I'd be neglectful if I didn't mention here that on the 14th of August at 4 p.m., we're actually opening an exhibit at the Dole Institute about the 76th convention, and would encourage everybody to come by and visit or go to the KC Library, where they have a similar exhibit that we worked with them on.
I've been to the Dole Institute a number of times. I've been fortunate to be at several events there, and I would say that go ahead and make the 45-minute drive over there. It's really an interesting place. So, gentlemen, would you say that that the party, the Republicans, left Kansas City united, or do you think that that the contentious nature of the convention, damaged their the fall campaign?
I don't think this is, go ahead, Bill.
No, you go ahead, Craig.
Craig, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. It's just that I don't see how the party could be, and I wasn't there at the time. My wife was; she was a young Ford supporter, but I've written extensively about it and studied it. And I don't see how, when Ronald Reagan is your principal opponent and he gets half the delegates in the hall, and it's a contentious 4-day. First of all, it's been contentious for 6 months. The Ford campaign ran commercials implying that Ronald Reagan was a warmonger. Is that there were a lot of personal jokes and insults that emanated from the Ford White House directed at Ronald Reagan. There was a lot of bitterness on the part of Nancy Reagan and Governor Reagan toward the Ford campaign. Bob Hartman, who was a Ford speechwriter, wrote in his book that the Reagans and the Ford couldn't even be in the same room with each other. They would just agitate each other into a frenzy. So I don't see how, at a personal level, at a political level, and an ideological level, how the party could have been unified. And as a matter of fact, I don't think it ever was.
Bill, what do you think about that?
Well, I would agree with that to a certain degree. I do think I would just use the Reagan speech on the last night of the convention. The president welcomed him after, and very rare. I don't know that this has ever occurred at another convention. The president asked Governor Reagan to come up and speak. The governor went up there. He gave an extraordinary, extraordinary speech that's often cited as being the thing, along with his speech for Goldwater in 64, A Time for Choosing, that propelled him in 1980. And I agree with Craig. The party wasn't truly united because there were very strong overtones still, and it was a very tough, tough fight. And it was a one-on-one fight. It wasn't 16 people in the race like we've seen in the current one. It was one-on-one all the way through. So it was very tough. But at the end of the day, I think most of those Reagan people wound up voting for Ford. And they certainly, everyone, everyone in the convention hall left saying Ronald Reagan has a big future in the Republican Party.
Was that a planned event when Reagan President Ford invites Reagan down to the podium? Was that planned? What do we know about that?
No, it was completely impromptu. As a matter of fact, it was all broadcast, of course, live on national television. And minutes before Gerald Ford invites Reagan down, Reagan is doing an interview with Tom Brokaw of NBC, and Tom Brokaw asks Reagan, he said, Governor, are you going to address the hall tonight? And Reagan said no. So it was completely impromptu. Ford family invites Reagan down, and as the family's all waving for him and everything else, Reagan is very reluctant. First, he's shaking his head. He's waving off the president. No, 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 no. And then finally, only reluctantly does he go down, you know, after 17,000 people are cheering, you know, we want Ron and speech, speech, speech. And as he's making his way to the podium, he turns to Mrs. Reagan and Mike Deaver, and she says, what am I going to say? And Mike Deaver said, don't worry, Governor, you'll think of something. And it goes to Bill's point, but it was probably one of the two up until that point most important political speeches in Reagan's career. But it was completely impromptu, completely extemporaneous, and completely historic.
And Bill, the extemporaneous nature of that speech makes it even more impressive. Yes.
Oh, absolutely. There was some discussion that perhaps Ford did that almost to catch Reagan off guard, almost to put him in a position where, you know,
right,
he was like he was. He didn't know exactly what he was going to do. But by golly, by the time he got down there, he wowed the delegates. And he had a lot of people leaving that hall, even Ford supporters saying that guy should have been our nominee this year.
Yeah. By the way, Craig, what do you think was the and I want to get to your thought here, but what was the most important political speech, do you think, of Reagan's career?
Clearly his 64 speech, yeah. Because he emerges Phoenix-like from the 64 campaign. Everybody else is decimated. Is that the party is broken, and some people think, you know, permanently so. The only two people who ironically came out of it well were Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, both because they exhibited party loyalty and stood by Goldwater when Nelson Rockefeller and Bill Scranton and George Romney all bolted on Barry Goldwater. So there's a lesson there about party loyalty being important even if your candidate doesn't win.
Yeah, you had some thoughts, one more thought on the Reagan speech in 76, Craig. What was that?
Well, just that it was visionary. It was Reagan's heart, and it set him apart. He never formally endorsed Gerald Ford, and I know that I talked to a lot of Ford people afterwards, and they were very bitter that even to today is that Reagan never said, you know, vote for Gerald Ford, support Gerald Ford, I endorse Gerald Ford. But he talked about things that were on his mind. He talked about the future. He talked about nuclear weaponry. He talked about democratic rule in America and what it was doing to freedom and individual rights and the free economy. So it was very much a visionary type of speech. It was not a political speech in the sense of saying to vote for this candidate or that candidate.
Bill, you agree that this laid out the vision for the party till maybe right now?
Yes, I would say certainly until around 2000, a little bit less starting with the Bush 43 administration, which when the party seemed to, perhaps from my point of view, get a little off track, get a little towards big government conservative. But I think Reagan clearly set the tone for several administrations to come.
Yeah. I want to talk just briefly about what this convention meant for the House and Senate in 1976, if in fact having Ford at the top of the ticket made any difference at all. Democrats controlled both the House and Senate in 1976. So, Craig, did it have an effect on these down-ticket races?
No, it didn't. It was a very singular, solitary election. Carter won, of course, and he picked up seats in the House and the Senate and the state legislative seats, but nothing near the coattails you would expect. But don't forget, too, it was a very close election. is that Ford caught up very quickly to Carter in September, October, and that Carter was an unusual, and I interviewed President Carter extensively for my book on the 80 campaign. He described himself as an odd sort of Democrat because he was for balanced budgets and human rights, and he ran very much as a populist outsider. You know, he was going to clean up Washington. He was going to, you know, cut out the bureaucracy. He was going to re-regulate Washington and simplify the government. He ran on a middle-class tax cut. So in many ways, he ran to the right of Gerald Ford.
Yeah. We've only got a couple minutes left, and I want to wrap up by giving you both a little bit of time just to reminisce a little bit about 1976, how you think that may play into the current RNC in Cleveland, and what you think the most important nugget is that we have to take away from that convention. Craig, let's start with you.
Well, 1976 was like the movie Rocky. Apollo Creed was Gerald Ford. He was the defending champion. Rocky Balboa was Ronald Reagan. He was the challenger. He was behind, you know, he was the underdog. He was behind on points. He went the distance. He scored best at the end, but the president and Apollo Creed both won on technical points in the end. But it did set him up, as with Rocky, for a rematch. It set up Ronald Reagan for the future. Both these men were extraordinarily good men. They were good, decent, honorable men, struggling in a very, very difficult time. The 70s were an awful time of, you know, we've lost Vietnam. We'd had one president assassinated, another president was banished for his contempt for the Constitution, out of control inflation, gas lines. It was a very, very bad time in this country's history. It was one of the most unremarkable, 10 years in the history of the American Republic. And yet, both these men cared deeply about their country. They cared deeply about the White House and power. And yet, there was never any whiff of dirty tricks that was ever associated with either campaign. They simply went about their job, trying to do the best job they could, make the case to the Republican primary voters that they would be the best nominee. But I think history has been very good to Ronald Reagan, obviously, but I think history has also been very good to Gerald Ford, and I think that's a good thing.
Gentlemen, I have thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. That was Craig Shirley, a Reagan scholar, joining us from his office in Washington, D.C. Craig, thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
And Bill Lacey from the Dole Institute, who joined us from our friends at Kansas Public Radio. Bill, thank you for your thoughts on this.
You're so welcome, Sam.